can just pull this up for you.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we have public hearings as well as work sessions. I have at least one member that needs to leave early, and because of that, we're going to go ahead and start with our work sessions, starting with a work session on Senate Bill 373. Aaron, if you could just give us a brief overview of what that measure is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 373 would modify the filing requirements pertaining to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. Basically, filing would now be done electronically in accordance with rules adopted by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. It would remove the obligation of Forfeiture Counsel to provide the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee with paper copies of the forfeiture judgment.
All right, and if you could just, for the record, tell us about any revenue or fiscal impact?
At this point, none is projected.
All right, great. Chair would entertain a motion on Senate Bill 373.
Mr. Chair, just what we have is may have, but no statement issued. Have we got the statement?
Sorry, I should have made that modification. There's not a fiscal projection.
There's not, okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It was my recollection that nobody signed up to testify about this bill, so I just wonder if there's some explanation of why we're moving it.
This was if I'm not mistaken, I believe Mr. Prince was scheduled to testify but was not able to testify because he needed to be at another meeting. I sit on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee and made some comments at the introduction, and that was all we took. This is basically allowing for and making it, but requiring that the asset counselors or counselors around the state to file their paperwork electronically. What is the issue is that staff time is impacted when stuff is coming in by paper, then they have to actually
scan it in
or get it, put it into the on that form. And if I remember correctly, all of the offices are capable of doing it electronically, and they just wanted it to make it uniform.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other comments or questions? Any objections to the motion? Chair will carry this bill to the floor since I am part of the Asset Oversight Advisory Committee. And that closes the work session on 373, and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 398.
Chair, I apologize. I'm asking for a copy of the fiscal to be rushed on 398. So
okay.
If we could stand at ease for just a moment.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and close the work session we just opened on Senate Bill 398. We'll come back to that, and we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings on public with Senate Bill 382.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 382 requires lien claimants to send notice of a filed claim only to mortgagees that comply with the overall requirement that they record their name and a current address with the relevant county clerk.
All right, and let's see, on 382, I have two people that look like they are up for giving testimony, Fritz Batson, I believe, and Kevin Christensen. Why don't y'all two come up while you're coming up? I'm going to recess that public hearing, get you a chance to come on up. I'm going to go ahead and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 398, and we now have the fiscal as it reflects minimum expenditure impact. So is there any discussion regarding the motion to I don't really think we have the motion on. So, Senator Cruz, would you like to make a motion on 398?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be opposing this bill. I make the motion because it's my job, but I have issues with perceived, and I know the court has ruled on that, but still I think it's a gray area, and I'm not comfortable with it.
understand. I appreciate you making the motion, and if you do have one in the future that you really don't want to make the motion, just let the chair know.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, making the motion is making the motion.
Right.
It's like...
I know. We've been heard long.
Right.
All right, and Senator Wissett, did you have comments?
I have the same concern.
And the microphone, please.
I have the same concern, Mr. Chair. I think that legislating criminal activity and criminal sanctions for perception is I have trouble finding the constitutional authority for that. I just don't think it's appropriate. I know that it's been done in the past, and this is just adding something to it, but I have opposed it right through the, you know, right, all the way along, and I will continue to oppose it. I would also ask you on the committee report here, is there a it says on the 1, 2, 3, 4 present ORS 166.165 states that a person commits the crime of intimidation of the first degree. I believe in the statute it says that it takes two or more people acting together to commit the crime of intimidation of the first degree. And I actually alerted the left a message with legislative staff on that, but I don't see any correction. So,
May I respond, Chair?
You should.
Chair's member of the committee, Senator Wetzet, I make reference to present ORS 166.165. You are correct, and it does state on the SMS that it must be done in concert with one or more individuals if they intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause injury to another. So I believe that is expressed in the background section.
Hmm.
That's what it says in the statute.
Well, I read it differently, but...
Okay. Any other comments? Discussion? All right. Objections to the motion? I see Senator Cruz, Senator Wissett. With that, it looks like the measure passes and we'll move forward. Senator Bonamici, will you carry this one to the floor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 398 and we'll reopen the public hearing on 382. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And whoever wants to lead off, if you'll just give us a name for ID and we'll be listening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Fritz Batts, and I'm an attorney from Eugene, Oregon, and am on the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Section, and that's who I'm here on behalf of. We have presented and proposed and support Senate Bill 382 to address a problem that has been encountered by lien claimants who have to send out notices on a very short time frame. And in the situation that we've been encountering or we have been seeing involves the partial assignment of trust deeds to as many as 250 partial assignees, many of them without their names or addresses on the partial assignments. As you may know, the construction lien statutes require certain lien claimants to give notice within 8 business days of commencing work and also require sending out a copy of the lien to all of the mortgagees and lenders within 20 days after filing the lien. In the situation where 250 partial assignees show up on the record without any addresses, it becomes a really impossible task for the small contractor, mom-and-pop operation, who wants to comply with the statute to do it. So all we are simply proposing in Senate Bill 382 is that the lien claimants only have to provide notice to those assignees of mortgagees and to mortgagees who actually comply with the recording statute and put their name and address on the document that's physically recorded. Likewise, we've been encountering other situations where private entities have shown up as nominees for mortgagees and have privately had a registration system for assignees, which and those assignees do not appear on the public records. And so our thought is, look, let's just require the lien claimants to only give notice to those lenders and assignees that comply with the already existing statute, and that's all they have to do. And that's the purpose of Senate Bill 382.
Great. Thank you very much. Kevin?
Members of the committee, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, Kevin Christensen, Oregon Bankers Association. I'll be very brief in my testimony. We are concerned anytime you start making lien notices for corporate property more restrictive. However, I think our primary concern is directed at Section 3 that would make this bill retroactive. We would seek that if this bill is going to move forward, that it would apply to mortgages and deeds of trust that are recorded after the effective date of the bill. Concern is, at least with our institutions, trying to troubleshoot going backwards whether or not they've satisfied the necessary requirements and whatnot. So we would want this to be, if it moves forward, as a prospective thing as opposed to a retrospective.
Questions, Senator Cruz.
Sounds reasonable. Right. That's a hell of a reach back.
So let me just get clarification. We're putting this on the record. So on the objection on Section 3, the retroactivity is for anything that has already been entered into. They've expressly gone in the contracts. The liens are not the liens, but the mortgages are already in place, as compared to having a new mortgage issued at the time after this act would go into effect. It would only affect those.
Thanks.
Chair Przanski, as I understand,
what we would say is, looking back, I think there's a lot of captured, as I would interpret this, that it would be mortgages and trust deeds recorded after the date of those specific documents recorded after the date of the effective date of the legislation, or if there's another date that it would apply to those.
Okay. So, again, just for clarification, based on Mr. Batson's testimony, if there's a duty for the holder of the mortgage to file the notice or they put the information on the deeds records, I guess is where it's captured, and they're not doing that, I'm trying to grasp, it seems to me, how does the individual who is trying to... give notice, know who to give notice to. They'd have to, do they have to actually find the documents where the mortgage actually was created and then give notice off of that? I'm trying to just get clarification of how that occurs, and that could be for either of you.
Chair Przanski, I think most of our lenders are going to, I don't want to overstate or understate the problem as far as our lenders are concerned. It's looking back and going, have we dotted every I and crossing every T? I think in most of the instances, that's going to be taken care of. However, it's the ones that we don't see, the ones that could be a problem. As far as finding those other people, I think there's going to be some investigation required. When I was in practice, I know that there were situations. Talked to the gentleman at the bar. There is, first of all, challenging timelines as far as that 20 days is concerned to get it out there. On the other hand, we're talking about restricting liens, and so I think there's an amount of investigation that needs to occur. Where that occurs, I think the records, it's I think incumbent upon the lien claimant to be making that analysis.
In a title company search that you'd ask, you'd call up a title company and ask them for who has an interest in this.
Right, and typically at some point in the process, the lien claimant will get a title report of some sort. The problem is the title reports come back showing partial assignees. You go and check the recorded document, and even though the statute requires the name and the address to be on the recorded document, it's not there. And these partial assignees could be located anywhere in the United States or who knows where, with names like the John Smith Family Trust. And you've got to try to find and locate those people all within, you know, 8 business days for your initial notice and 20 days after you file your lien. So the problem is that what is already statutorily required in the recording document is not there and has not been there in instances we've been encountering.
Okay.
So that's right. Where the problem is.
All right. So I'm going to see if there's any other questions. I'm going to ask y'all to follow up on this. So let everyone know that I'm going to ask them to be talking.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, is there a perceived liability here because we're not contacting these partial folks? I mean,
the situation that at least I personally have encountered is when one of the partial assignees can't be located within the time period required for the preliminary notices, when you finally locate them and serve them with the lawsuit, they challenge the priority of the lien and whether or not it's a valid lien. And so it's not just a perceived problem, it's one that actually we have encountered where liens have been challenged, and the priority of the liens have been challenged because the people could not be located within the time periods that are specified.
And again, I think one of the issues, at least for most of, again, I don't want to overstate or understate the problem. I mean, most of our lenders, their documents are going to have the necessary information to cover and receive the necessary lenders. The concern that we've expressed is that we're going to be looking back over three different, you know, over 3 years of documentation that's sitting there. And does every lender have to go back and now do an entire review of their portfolios to see whether or not every last dot is dotted, T is crossed? Again, I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill here, but I think it is a concern that our bankers have.
Okay. Senator Whitsett.
Yeah, thank you. Just briefly, do either of you have any idea how many mortgages might be affected by this reach back to January 1, 2008?
Senator Whitsett, Chair Przanski, I don't have a number as far as what kind of reach that would have.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsett, I don't have a number. What I do know is that date is chosen because the statute which requires that information, that was the effective date of that statute. So the retroactivity aspect of this is to the date that the statute originally required the name and address to be on the assignee's recorded document. But I have no idea of the volume of them. All I know is the ones that we have actually encountered.
The next question was some estimate of the cost to the private sector in correcting and redoing these things, but obviously we don't know how many. We have no idea what the cost would be.
Thank you.
All right, and just in response to what I'm hearing, it sounds like that this date that we've chosen for this legislation actually was the date when lenders were supposed to be providing this information to set the notice, so the retro back 3 years as to that particular date of when that obligation was required to be done?
That's correct. It's okay.
205-234-1G, that was the effective date of that provision of the recording statutes.
All right. So at this point, this is only a public hearing. What I'm going to ask y'all to do is maybe be working together. I think the issues here, I think there's some legitimate concerns on both parts. But I will say that if we are only going back to the date where it was required for the lenders to actually file this information, I have a little bit more comfort there. But at the same time, maybe we can find a date between that date and coming forward a year or whatever that would give more consistency for that changeover where someone may not have actually done it properly in the first 6 months of once the law went into effect or something like that. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that this would apply only to the transactions that are MERS transactions. Is that
not only MERS. We have encountered them with an entity called Acuity, and FISERV Council is aware of that situation, and that is the entity where we encountered the problem with the partial assignees of they divided up one trustee into 250 partial assignees, recorded assignments without addresses on them.
Right, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Just as a matter of principle, I have issues when we put something in a law and say this is the way you will do something, and then people are operating with the assumption that this is the way we're going to do it, and then we come back and say we're going to change it, and we're going to change it over a period of time. You've already been complying with what's in law. And, you know, going forward from the date that we make the change, I have no problem with. I do have issues with backward looks that change a practice that's been in place, that we put in place. So, you know, maybe some more information on this. But it's just, you know, it'd be nice to know what the impacts clearly would be on the look back.
Okay. Other comments? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Let me ask before you all move away, I know Mr. Batson, you can just stay there, but let me see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 382. Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll close that public hearing. We're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 383. Aaron?
Yep. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 383 allows the initial or secondary notice of residential defect to be sent by certified mail. would exempt small claims and counterclaims relating to a contract for the construction, alteration, or repair of a residence system or component or material incorporated into a residence from this allowance.
All right. Mr. Batson, if you can put your name on the record again, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fritz Batson. I'm an attorney from Eugene, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Section in support of Senate Bill 383. This bill primarily relates to the notice of defect statutes that are where the current statute requires a owner to give notice to a contractor and an opportunity to come in and inspect and cure a problem prior to filing a lawsuit. The process typically requires sending that notice in strict accordance with the statute, including by registered mail. Certified mail is not listed, and it also includes an inspection process, secondary notices, and then a 90-day time frame for the contractor to respond. What this bill does is, first of all, kind of takes out the trap of for even small consumers and people like that who may have sent a letter to their contractor by certified mail, but not by registered mail, and it allows those folks to send out their notice by certified or registered mail. That's one of the changes. The second change is with respect to small claims, amounts below the small claims jurisdictional limit. The process has been cumbersome. It involves a 90-day wait. Frequently, the people that are involved in small claims do not have attorneys to prepare the notices. And so the idea is to exempt the notice of defect requirement in small claims actions simply because it's been too cumbersome in that situation. The third change is to address a situation where the contractor or somebody else has already sued the owner and there's an issue over the quality of the work, and the owner then will be bringing a counterclaim. Currently, the process that has been fought about is whether or not they have to then send a notice of defect, wait 90 days for the process to go forward, and then ultimately bring the counterclaim, all of which slows down the process of efficiently resolving the dispute between the owner and the contractor. So as a result, those are the three changes that are currently proposed under Senate Bill 383.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Not seeing any. Fritz, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 383? Not seeing anyone, we'll close that public hearing, and we'll open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 590.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee.
Senate Bill 590 regulates the replacement of an administrative law judge under for any given proceeding. Under the current legal regime, ORS 183645, any party to the proceeding without a showing of good cause can make one request for a different administrative law judge. Any subsequent request would require a showing of cause. Senate Bill 590 would sort of take away that first challenge and require that any motion for a substitution of administrative law judge be made for cause.
All right, thank you. We have one person scheduled, or at least listed, that wants to give testimony. Sybil, why don't you come on up? And what I'm going to do is ask Aaron if you would also put on the record as to your understanding how this challenge works in regular court for either civil cases or criminal cases.
Well, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, there really is no analog to criminal cases that I would be aware of for an administrative law judge, but civilly, basically, if you find yourself in the context of an administrative law judge, you would just notify the sitting court, the chief, most likely administrative law judge, if you wanted a change, and they would grant that change in a sort of pro forma way. There would be no showing. To do it more formally would require a record and a legal finding that cause exists.
All right. And I apologize. Senator Wissett, you are the sponsor of the bill. I should go ahead and have you give testimony. You can give it here at the dais.
Very good.
Thank
you.
Going to the,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Office of Administrative Hearings was established by House Bill 2525 in 2000. A number of compromises were reached in order to pass that bill, and over the years we have addressed a number of those compromises that didn't work out very well, most recently in 2009. One interesting and problematic provision of House Bill 2525 that has not yet been changed is the automatic right of a party or agency to recuse without cause an administrative law judge assigned to the case. The requester must show good cause for a second request to disqualify an ALJ, but not the first. We believe that the provisions allowing a peremptory challenge of an ALJ without cause is both inappropriate as well as being unfair. We doubt that if an ALJ is ever recused by a party or an agency for no cause, there's always a cause. The current law allows the ALJ to be recused without stating a cause, such as a concern for how the ALJ may have ruled in one or more previous cases or a perceived lack of competence on the subject matter. But, I mean, there may be other reasons. It is unfair because the agency boards and commissions arguably have a much better opportunity to determine how an ALJ may have ruled in a similar hearing in the past. Those situations where the private party is represented by counsel, that might not be the case. But in many of these cases, in many of these administrative hearings, the party is not represented by counsel and has no idea what the ALJ may or may not have done in the past and has no idea what the ALJ's qualifications may be. Senate Bill 590 is a very simple measure that corrects that inequity. It simply requires that they show cause, that either party show cause in order to disqualify an ALJ that's been assigned by the chief ALJ to the hearings case. So I think it's a good bill, and I would appreciate a good conversation.
Great. Thank you. Sybil.
Thank you, Chair Posansky, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, here today to express some concerns about Senate Bill 590 as it's drafted. As you know, we represent low-income Oregonians. A great number of our clients use the administrative hearings process in important matters such as public benefits issues, unemployment insurance hearings, and many other types of circumstances. And as the Senator mentioned, a good number of low-income Oregonians end up going through the administrative process without representation because they're not able to access an attorney. And the right to both the perception and the reality of a fair and impartial hearing in the administrative context is crucial, and just as crucial in that context as it is in the circuit court context. We like the current statute in that it allows a recusal one time for either a party or an agency without having to file a formal motion and indicate good cause. I would agree with the Senator that perhaps agencies may have a better sense of whether or not there is good cause in any circumstance, but they'll also be able to do a better job of identifying and illuminating that, and they would have a better chance under the bill at ever succeeding at a motion for recusal. An individual, low-income individual, oftentimes without an attorney, may have the sense of unfairness or bias for whatever reason, and whether or not that's an accurate sense, that person ought to be entitled to the sense that he or she is getting a fair trial. And so I think the concept of an automatic recusal is codified in the current statute as a means of just saying, you know, whatever the cause, you can ask for a new judge so that you have the feeling that of impartiality and the reality, hopefully, of impartiality. And so it's my understanding that the current law has resulted not in too many requests for recusal, and that those requests are more or less balanced between requests from agencies and requests for from individuals. But I know there are people in the room here who can speak more specifically to those statistics. In our experience, if there were going to be a change to the Chapter 183 administrative law recusal provisions, we would prefer that they look more like the statutes in Chapter 14, which apply to recusals of circuit court judges. And that statute also codifies the principle that you ought to be able to have one request without having to show good cause and making a factual determination. That's a barrier that's really hard for low-income individuals who are unrepresented to satisfy. And the statute in ORS Chapter 14 does provide a little bit more oversight for those requests in that if the judge who's asked to recuse him or herself thinks that the motion is made not in good faith, they have the right to challenge that. And maybe that would be a more appropriate way to narrow the administrative hearing challenges. But in our opinion, the current statutes work well and best for the low-income, unrepresented individuals because they don't require formal pleadings and they don't require that person to set out all of the specifics that they may not have the ability to, they may not understand or have access to. So we appreciate the goal behind the bill and just want to make sure to put those concerns on the record.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have records of the number of unrepresented private parties that have challenged a ALJ? Because on the Office Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee, I don't believe that we determined that there were very many, if any, that had actually challenged a judge. It turns out that the agencies are the primary ones, and primarily it's DHS that has challenged the mid-preemptive challenge. So do you have that those figures?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt, and members, and I do not. I believe that there's someone in the audience who has more statistics. In my experience, we see that the recusals are not asked for frequently, but that it's more or less a balance between agencies and individuals. But I don't have statistics on that, so I defer to the numbers.
Thank you.
It'd be good to have those numbers.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Aaron? All right. Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Sybil, you said that your perception, if I understood you correctly, is that this, the way this is now, that you get sort of a freebie without having to make a formal finding of cause and have a hearing, mirrors the existing system with other judges, with circuit court judges. My perception, and I'm mostly familiar with criminal, is that if you want a new judge, if you get sent out for trial and you don't like who you ended up with, that you actually have to file an affidavit stating, I don't believe I will receive a fair trial. There's normally not any subsequent need for a hearing after that, but any attorney can only do it so often, and if a major agency does it, it's a tremendously big deal. So I suppose I'm sort of curious how it is that administrative law came to operate in such, what at least looks to be such a different way.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm familiar with the civil process and not the criminal, so we have opposite experiences, but in my experience in looking at Chapter 14 and its 14.250 and 260, the person needs to make a challenge to the judge saying that, or to the assignment of judge, indicating that they don't believe that they can have a fair trial, but they don't, the statute specifically says there need be no specific basis set forth, and that request shall be granted unless the judge who's asked to be recused believes that the request is made in bad faith. So that's the dynamic that I'm referring to.
And thank you again, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. So I understand then that the requirement of filing an affidavit saying party does not believe they would receive a fair and balanced trial from this judge is the same then in criminal, civil, and administrative.
I believe in administrative hearings you don't need to specifically allege that you don't think you will get a fair trial. You merely need to ask for a recusal. In my view, that's more or less the same thing. You don't. In either case, for the first challenge, you do not need to allege specific facts that would rise to the level of a finding of making a finding of good cause. It's and the recusal shall be granted upon that initial prima facie request.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. I've got Senator Bonamici. I'm going to come back to Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to that question and discussion. It would be my sense that it would be much more likely that someone in the judicial system would be represented, and in the administrative system probably would be without counsel, which would explain the difference in policy.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Sybil. In your case, you're citing Chapter 14 and the request for recusal of a judge, but the judge has the right to object to the recusal. If he objects, he or she objects, what happens then?
Not sure yet.
Senator Cruz, the statute specifies what the steps should be, and if the judge challenges that the good faith of the motion, then there can be a hearing set before a different judge to determine what should happen and whether there was bad faith.
Right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's my understanding in the current administrative procedure, there is no requirement that any cause be articulated, that you simply say, I don't want that person, and that's the end of it. There is no opportunity for the rebuttal on the part of the administrative law judge. If that same law judge is recused sequentially by an agency 50 times, he or she has absolutely no recourse other than just to step aside and have someone else, the chief ALJ Forsyth would have to replace them. To me, it seems inequitable, and I help me understand how you think that process where there is no rebuttal, there is no opportunity for any discussion. It is just, you know, okay, I don't want that judge, you're out. How does that compare with the process in the judicial process where there is, and we're comparing an administrative hearings process with the judicial process, which to begin with may not be a germane comparison, but help us understand how you think that they compare and how a recusal of administrative law judges simply because they say I don't want that person comports with the process in the court.
Sure. Senator Whitsitt, you're correct that in the administrative process no allegation that the judge is unfair need be made. It's just a simple request for a recusal, whereas in circuit court you need to at least allege that you believe that you will not have a fair trial. And in circuit court the judge has the right to challenge the good faith of that motion. And we would not have an objection to having a process in the administrative proceeding that was similar to the process in the circuit court proceeding in allowing the judge to make a challenge to the good faith of the motion. To me, it's not from my perspective and looking at the experiences of our clients, I think to get to your question about sort of the comparison between the two, for many individuals and probably especially for low-income individuals, especially those who don't have representation, the administrative process, the administrative hearing, that's their access to justice. That's, you know, where the determinations about their benefits or their lives are being made. And so that's why we feel that there are similar interests involved in both of the proceedings. And I think that the appearance of bias is just as important for the court to maintain, and that's true throughout all of the rules that govern judges' jobs and attorneys' jobs. That's just as important to maintain as the actuality of impartiality. And so if a person standing before a deciding body has the feeling that it's not a fair proceeding, that's to be avoided. And so I think that the ability for a person to make the request and to not have to show specific details or thoughts about why that's true.
Thank you. Would we follow up? What would the ALJ respond to? There's been no charge. There has been no allegation. So how would the ALJ respond to defend their position when there is no allegation they did anything wrong? They just simply were shoved aside. How would they respond?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, I think that it could work similarly if you were to require that there be an allegation of impartiality. If an ALJ has received 20 such challenges from an agency time and time again, that might give rise to their concern. Or, you know, depending on the facts, they could make a challenge based on what their understanding of the situation was.
All right. Any other questions or comments for Sewell? All right, and I forget your name.
Carla Forsyth.
Carla Forsyth. You're here. You're one of the administrative law judge.
She's the chief
officer.
Yes. Why don't you come on up? We do have a couple of questions that came up. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put you on the spot. And you may not have the information. There was a couple of questions as to these type of challenges that are occurring at the ALJ level that your office would be handling. Can you give us some ballpark of how many are coming from either side?
I do have statistics on that.
I need you to first put your name on the record.
Oh, Carla Forsyth, Chief Administrative Law Judge, Office of Administrative Hearings. We have reviewed statistics twice for the Oversight Committee and used fiscal year statistics. I looked at calendar year 2010 for the statistics I have today. We were able to track recusal information for 4,388 cases. The other cases are high volume cases where our mainframe just doesn't have the capability to do that. But in the cases where we can track this information, there were 23 recusal requests, 12 came from the agency, 11 came from the parties. And again, this is calendar year 2010.
Okay. Great. That's wonderful. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Being a volunteer. All right. Anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 590? Not seeing anyone. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 590. And, Aaron, I think that takes care of everything.
That's correct, sir.
So, for the record, I guess I need to say what time we're going to be starting tomorrow, and that's going to be 8:30. So, with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you.